1 John 1:10, 2:12. The third talk in a series on the Apostle John's letters was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 17, 2012, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A PDF of Dr. Crabtree's translation of John's letters and the Greek text of John's letters accompanies this series. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
We really get into the heart of his argument, or the main body of his argument. He has a sort of an introductory preface. We looked last week at what I would call his explanation of his standpoint, his purpose, and his motive. His standpoint is as one who is an eyewitness. He saw with his own eyes, felt with his own hands, heard with his own ears the teaching of Jesus, saw the miracles of Jesus, all the data that he needed to understand that this really was the Son of God bringing the word of life into the world. He was an eyewitness to all of that and is speaking from that perspective. His purpose is to share with his readers what it is that he knows as an eyewitness, because he wants to reassure, ultimately we're going to see that he wants to reassure them that they have not been misled by the older generation among them who have said, here's what the apostles came and told us was the teaching of Jesus and the claims of Jesus. They haven't been misled by that. They really are on the right track if they believe the apostolic gospel. And that his motive is simply that they can have the joy that comes from having the confidence that they really do stand to inherit eternal life. They have not been led away from life. They, in fact, have been led toward life. That's his purpose. Then he starts a section where he's going to share with them basically three perspectives, there are three claims that he makes that are going to function for him like criteria for how he would evaluate the claims of these false teachers. And we looked at the first one last week. No one has koinonia with God who does not live in the light of God's truth, which is to say, no one has koinonia with God who does not live like Jesus did. Because Jesus lived his life in the light of God's truth. So if you are living your life in the light of God's truth, you will look like you believe the same things Jesus believed, value the same things Jesus valued, and so on. And koinonia, as we talked about last week, usually translated fellowship, but grossly misunderstood often. What he means by koinonia here is basically to hold in common the same understanding of reality that God does. To have koinonia with God is to look at life and reality the way God looks at life and reality, to know life and reality as God knows life and reality. So if you're making a claim, as these false teachers undoubtedly are, we're here to tell you how God looks at reality. Let us tell you how it is. They're claiming to have koinonia with God, and yet John surmises their lives don't look like Jesus' life did. They're not living as he lived. They're not walking as he walked. So there's something wrong with their claim to see reality the way God does, given the way they're living their lives. So that's what we looked at last week. He then applies that principle in a very, very powerful and significant way. How does God look at reality? What's the light that he has shined on our situation? We are sinners. We are shot through with hostility to our Creator, antagonism to our Creator. We are depraved creatures. We are not the kind of creatures that we ought to be. The teachers, I would argue, he doesn't say it explicitly here, but the only way to make sense out of it occurring in this location, in this letter, in the way that it does, is he understands that the false teachers are denying the reality of personal sin. No, we're not sinners. And I tried to make that plausible last week with the man that I was debating, who kept insisting that he had no sin. He had had an experience where he left sin behind in his life once and for all. And then when I got into a conversation, if I were to ask your wife whether you're ever impatient or anything like that, what would she say? And his response, if you recall, was, well, that's not sin. That's just being human. And I think something like that is the kind of dodge that these false teachers are using. I'm not sinful. I'm human. You know, I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. But God doesn't condemn you for making mistakes in your humanity. He only condemns you, and I think what they are saying is, he condemns you for transgressing the Mosaic Covenant. You don't want to do that. That'll get you condemnation. But just being a jerk, there's no law in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not be a jerk, so you're okay. And then he makes a parenthetical comment on how to respond to the reality of personal sin. You should strive against it. I'm not telling you that you're sinners so that you can indulge your sinfulness, he says. You shouldn't sin just because you're sinners. You should strive against it. I write these things to you that you not sin. But if you do sin, the good news is we have an advocate who is going to intercede for us and is going to ask our Father for mercy rather than the condemnation that my sin deserves. So there's no reason not to confess, to admit to acknowledge my sinfulness. I don't need to hide it. I don't need to defend it. I don't need to deflect it. I don't need to dodge it. I can just face squarely into the reality of my sinfulness because I have nothing to lose. I have an advocate who's going to say, I want him in my kingdom. But do you know how sinful he is? I know how sinful he is, but I want him in my kingdom. And that advocate is what secures life for us. It's not my goodness that does that. Okay. Now we get to paragraph 6 then. Let's read paragraph 6. Now what I'm arguing now is he moves on to a second truth, which becomes a second criteria that he would use to evaluate the false teachers. Now by this we can ascertain that we know Jesus if we keep Jesus' instructions. The one who says that he knows him and yet is not except keeping his instructions, he's a liar, and the truth is not within him. But whoever accepts his account, surely in this one God's love has attained its intended result. I'll go on to 7. By this we can ascertain that we are followers of Jesus, the one claiming that he remains a faithful follower of him. He is himself under obligation to walk, just as that one walked. Okay? So here's the second truth. The first one was claiming that I have koinonia with God. This one is, I'm a follower of Jesus. I know Jesus. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm making a claim that I know Jesus. Again, I think this was a claim that the false teachers were making. They were making the claim that they somehow know Jesus. So unlike your fathers, younger people, unlike your fathers who learned this gospel from the apostles, right, allegedly, they don't know what they're talking about. I don't know where they got their gospel, but they didn't get it from the apostles, or even if they got it from the apostles are not telling you the straight scoop about what Jesus taught, because we know Jesus. They may mean that indirectly. We knew people who knew Jesus, but we have the straight scoop on what Jesus taught, so we know him. And to them he says, by this we can ascertain that we know Jesus if we keep Jesus' instructions. The one who says that he knows him and yet is not keeping his instructions, he's a liar, and the truth is not with him. Okay, so John is going to say, I would dismiss them, and I would dismiss all of their claims if their teaching doesn't measure up and conform to Jesus' teaching. Now, remember last week I said these are criteria that John can use. These are not criteria that we can use. And do you see why now? I mean, who am I to say whether or not somebody coming along saying, I knew Jesus and here's what he said, I'm going to say, you're a liar? I mean, how would I know? I wasn't with Jesus. I don't have any resources to be able to confront that and negate what they're saying. But John does. John starts the thing by saying, what we saw with our eyes, what we touched with our hands, what we gazed upon and studied, that's what we, concerning the word of life, that's what we proclaim to you. That's what I proclaim to you. That is, as an eyewitness and as an apostle in particular, he's in a position to be able to take what these false teachers are saying and stack it up against what he heard with his own ears, Jesus teach, and go, you don't know Jesus. You never have known Jesus. What you are representing as his teaching is so far off, it's not even close. This is laughable. Okay, so this is a criteria that John would apply, not us. Okay, now by this we can ascertain that we know Jesus if we keep Jesus' instructions. Notice I have it in italics because it's just literally his, I believe, in the text, that we know him if we keep his instructions. But I would contend that if you put all this stuff in this paragraph together, he ends it by saying he is himself under obligation in the last of the paragraph 7. He is himself under obligation so to walk just as that one walked, and I left it that one there. For some reason, it's part of John's idiom that when he wants to refer to Jesus, he often calls him that one for some reason. So Jesus is the one in view here. If we claim that we know Jesus, then we will keep his instructions. Okay, this is critical. What does he mean, keep his instructions? And okay, well, let me do it in the reverse order. I translated it in instructions. A lot of English translations will have commandments there, if we keep his commandments. The Greek word is entole, and entole doesn't mean narrowly commandments in the way we think of commandments. I mean, when I think of a commandment, the only thing that qualifies as a commandment is when somebody commands you to behave in a particular way or act in a particular way. That's a commandment. But we've just seen one of the entole of Jesus in the paragraph before. If we say that we have no sins, we make him a liar. We have no sin. We make him, Jesus, a liar. Why? Because Jesus taught us that we are sinners. That's part of his instruction to us. When he came and taught us, he taught us that we are all sinners. So keeping his entelai, keeping his instructions include not only how he said we are obligated to live and behave, it includes that, but it includes factual claims he was making about us and God and himself. Part of his instruction is, I am the Messiah sent from God. Well, that's not a commandment. That's a statement of fact. Well, if you keep his instructions, you're going to keep that too. That's going to be a big deal later in the letter. You're going to keep the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. Which brings us to, that sounds odd to us because growing up in Christian culture, if you're anything like me, keeping a commandment is synonymous with obeying a commandment. I think keeping a teaching is to obey the teaching. But that's not what the word means. We still have the concept of keeping. It still survives in our word keepsake. Or I'm going to store this away for safekeeping. In Lord of the Rings, they went to the keep. The fortress at the end of the valley, they went behind the keep. What is a keep? It's a fortress where you can stay safe, where you can be guarded. You can be secure because you're being guarded. To keep the instructions of Jesus is to guard them, protect them, preserve them. And why would you guard, protect, and preserve the teaching of Jesus? Because you value them. If you think they're important, if you think they're true, if you think that they are, if you think they have the value that that God thinks they do and that Jesus thinks they do, you will treasure them. And a treasure is something that you don't treat casually. You don't leave it out where it can be destroyed or stolen. You safeguard it. You safeguard it precisely because it's valuable. That all that's implicit in keeping. That's what Moses meant in Deuteronomy when he commanded Israel to keep the covenant. He's not just saying, obey this stuff. It involves that. It includes that, certainly. But even more than that, don't forget it. Don't lose it. Don't let it disappear from your memory. Study it, memorize it, cherish it, treasure it. This is a valuable covenant. Don't throw it away. That's keeping it. Okay. That's the way he's using the word here. We know the person who no one who knew Jesus would fail to keep what Jesus taught us, to treasure it, value it, and therefore preserve and protect it. Okay. The one who says that he knows him and yet is not keeping his instructions, he's a liar. So there's this inherent contradiction between anyone who would claim to know Jesus and have any sort of flippant disregard for Jesus' teaching. That he says that's not possible. You don't really know Jesus then. You're making a false claim, a wild claim to know him, but you don't really know him. You're a liar. And not only are you lying about your relationship with Jesus, but you're also missing out on the truth because the truth is not within. The one who says that he knows him and yet is not keeping his instructions, he's a liar in his claim to know Jesus, and he has rejected the truth, and the truth is not in him. But whoever accepts his account, his logos, whoever accepts the logos that Jesus brought, and back in the first paragraph he said, what is it that he wants to tell them he knows? It's what Jesus told us about the logos of life. His account of how one attains eternal life is the logos of life. Whoever accepts his Jesus account, by implication, of life, surely in this one, God's love has attained its intended result. Okay, what is he getting at there? Okay, first of all, I need to talk about my translation. Most translations have God's love has been perfected, probably, something like that. A very, very unfortunate translation, because to our ears, perfection is not having any blemishes. That's not really even what this word means. It's not a matter of not having any blemishes or any defects. The root word is telos, to have attained its telos. Telos is, you know, if I set out to run a 4-minute mile, is that, that's not even a big deal anymore, is it? For me, it would be. If I set out to run a 4-minute mile, if I achieve it, I've achieved my telos, my goal, my purpose, the end that I have set for myself. That's a telos. Nature has sort of built into an acorn that its telos is an oak tree. So when an acorn grows into an oak tree, it has attained its built-in telos. That's the basic idea of telos. Well, God's love had a telos. John is implying here. God's love has a telos. God directed his love toward mankind to bring about a certain state of affairs that he had intended, that he had set as a goal, that he had set as an end to the activity of his love. Well, what was that? That we come to believe the account that his son Jesus brought into the world about how you attain life. It's what elsewhere we call faith. God's telos for me is faith. Belief, an open receptivity that makes me embrace the truth from God rather than reject it. Well, implicit in what John is saying here, he doesn't spell it out, but it's certainly implicit in what he's saying, is none of us would believe it if God did not direct his love toward us. Because naturally, we're not inclined to accept and embrace anything from God. We're hostile to God. We're antagonistic toward God. We're prone to reject God and anything that has anything to do with God. So it takes a miracle, really, for any of us to ever all of a sudden have eyes to see and ears to hear and wake up and go, wow, this is the truth. I need to do business with this because it's just true. Why do we get there? We don't start there, and it doesn't come naturally to us. God has loved us if that happens in our life. He's worked in my insides to give me eyes to see, ears to hear, a heart that's receptive such that I respond believingly to the truth that God, that Jesus has revealed. So this, he doesn't do anything with this. He just sort of drops this sentence in here. Whoever accepts Jesus' gospel of life, surely in this one, God's love has attained its intended result. God's love has gone to work and has reached its goal in our lives. By this, we can ascertain or know that we are followers of Jesus. So I think he's using this synonymously with knows Jesus in the paragraph before. By this, we can ascertain that we are followers of Jesus. Okay, right. Most of your translations are going to have, by this, we can ascertain that we are in Jesus. Literally in him, I believe. By this we know that we are in him. And I'm going to argue over and over again throughout John that that's a particularly idiomatic phrase that John uses. He uses it in the Gospel of John, and he uses it in the letters of John. That his way, his shorthand, really kind of slang-like phrase for identifying somebody as a follower of Jesus is to describe that person as in Jesus, in him, in Christ. Those are the phrases he uses. And that's how I'm taking it here. When it says, by this we know that we are in him, by this we can ascertain that we are followers of Jesus, the one claiming that he is in him, or Noah abides in him, that is, the one claiming that he remains in him, a faithful follower of him, he is himself under obligation so to walk just as that one walked. So he uses the same criteria. In the case of koinonia, how do you know that you have koinonia with God? You're going to end up living like Jesus did. How do you know that you are a faithful follower of Jesus? You're going to live like Jesus lived. Anyone who lives inconsistently with the way Jesus lives, he's making a bogus claim to be his disciple or his follower.
Do you have a basis from like rabbinical literature or some kind of not Johannine source where, like, for instance, if there was maybe a rabbi, they would say that so and so was in the rabbi, that as an idiomatic expression of them being a follower of that rabbi's teaching. Do you know of anything like that? Or
I the closest thing is in the New Testament. It's not in him, but they usually translate it of him. Remember in that passage in 1 Corinthians where he's talking about, I'm glad that I didn't, well, he eventually gets around to saying, I'm glad I didn't baptize many of you. Oh yeah, I did baptize so and so and so. But that's an answer to a dispute. Some are saying, I am of Cephas, I am of Paul, I am of James. I think in him for John is his idiomatic way of saying exactly that same thing, where Paul says of somebody, of so-and-so.
So in Paul, the genitive of association, basically by being associated with someone of some clout, of some authority, I am associating myself with them. I'm putting myself as someone who stands in their teaching. And you're taking the preposition in to be indicative of like a kind of association, rather than using a genitive. I'm putting myself in the realm of the rabbi. I'm placing myself in their realm.
Yeah, and it's probably not in their realm. It's, think of it as a mathematical set. I mean, the set of all people who follow Jesus. Are you in the set or are you out of the set?
Like, are the people of God the set? Or,
yeah. I mean, they're thinking more narrowly here as people who are making a conscious claim of being Jesus' disciples or being his followers. Well, define that as an abstract set of people. there are those people who are followers of Jesus, and there are those people who are not followers of Jesus. So draw a circle here. If you are a follower of Jesus, you're inside the circle. If you're not a follower of Jesus, you're outside the circle. Well, are you in or are you not in? Are you in him or are you not in him? I think that's the logic behind his idiom. And I have never run into anyone else using that. That's why I call it an idiom. But John just uses it over and over and over again in the gospel and in his letter.
I guess the only difficulty I have is that him, in him, seems to be putting him as the, he is the circle that I'm in, rather than me being in a set. But if it's idiomatic, of course it can go in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, if you take it literally, then he is the one you're in. But that's what I'm saying, is that it doesn't have to be literal. Question?
So, Logan, in Logan's manner, has a statement that's a question, basically. So it sounds like John is doing something very similar to what Paul does in Galatians in his anti-disclaimer about how if he ever teaches anything that is against what he proclaimed Jesus to teach, that it shouldn't be listened to.
Right.
And in this case, he says that teachers or apostles can claim a sinless status. That Logan's saying, just that in this case, in what John's teaching, that what's opposed to whatever Jesus taught was that teachers or can claim a
sinless
status.
False teachers.
Yeah.
Yes, the false teachers are claiming. Yeah, well, it's going to be more than that. The bigger thing in the letter is going to be they deny that Jesus is the Christ. So they're clearly not keeping the teaching of Jesus, because Jesus did claim to be the Christ. They're saying, no, he didn't. And John knows firsthand that he did. So they are not keeping the actual teaching of Jesus. So that's going to be the most important thing that they don't believe. But we've just seen another thing that they reject, and that is the claim that we have sin. They're also denying that. So they're not keeping the teaching of Jesus in that regard. Okay. So I want to press on, unless you have some questions about 6 and 7. Okay. Now, he's going to come up with a third criteria. But before he does that, he inserts a little paragraph where he characterizes his teaching. Beloved, I am not writing to you a new teaching, but rather with the old and original teaching of Jesus, which you have had from the beginning. The old and original teaching of Jesus, that is the account that you have already heard. Yet again, I am writing to you with a new teaching, and that's where I changed the translation. I changed my mind about what's going on there. Let me look at the change here. Yet again, I am writing to you with a new teaching, period. What is true for the disciple of Jesus is in fact true among you, namely that the darkness is fading away and the true light is already shining. So I've made it a disciple of Jesus, but again, it's that phrase in him. What is true in him is in fact true among you, namely that the darkness is fading away and the true light is already shining. So what is he saying? What is true for anyone who is in him, a disciple of his, is true of you guys, that the darkness is fading away and the true light is already shining. So throughout this whole paragraph, what is the old and original teaching? It's what you heard from the beginning. It's the account that you have already heard. So he's over, you know, two or three times here in this paragraph, he's underlining the fact that the teaching that I would present to you is the teaching that you already know. You don't need to be corrected. You don't need your gospel to be changed. You don't need a new version of the gospel. The version of the gospel that you guys are already in possession in, that's what Jesus came into the world to teach us. So he's underlining that fact. You know, remember, he's writing these things that your joy might be made full, that you can have the confidence that you have not been misled, and that the truth that you claim to be the truth actually is the truth. So what he's doing here is characterizing his teaching to them in this writing as being nothing new. I'm not bringing a newfangled, This is not a new version. This is not an updated version. This is not a corrected version. This is not an edited version. This is not a second draft of the gospel of Jesus. I'm not going to tell you anything that you don't already know. It's the same old teaching that you've received. And but rather with the old, he just uses the word old. I added and original, with the old teaching. But what he means by is the teaching that Jesus brought into the world, because that's what he's been talking about this whole time, which you have had from the beginning. Well, what beginning is he talking about? The beginning of their encounter with the gospel of Jesus. The first time some missionary or evangelist came into town, sent by an apostle, and proclaimed the gospel of Jesus to you, that's the teaching that I'm going to deliver to you, and you had it from the very outset of you being a disciple at all, of calling yourself a Christian at all. What is the old and original teaching? It's the account that you have already heard. Yet again, but in another sense, so on the one hand, I'm not telling you anything new. On the other hand, the old, what's the hymn? The old story, yeah. The old story is actually, on the one hand, a new teaching, always new, always revolutionizing, always radical, always making a difference. Yet again, I am writing to you with a new teaching, and what is true of the disciple of Jesus is also true in you, he's saying. So he's expressing his confidence one more time that they really are bona fide disciples of Jesus. Because what should be true of a disciple of Jesus, I have evidence that it's true in you, namely that the darkness is fading away and the true light is already shining. So in what sense is it new? Well, if you want to bring it into contrast with the darkness that used to pervade the whole world universally before Jesus came into the world, then this teaching is new by comparison with that. If we want to contrast it with the folly and foolishness and blindness that you lived in before you met Jesus and listened to his teaching, then yes, this is new. Because this is bringing new light into your existence, into your being, into your way of being and your way of life. It's bringing new light into that. So in that sense, it's new, certainly. I don't want to take away from that, he's saying. But what I want to insist on is I'm not going to tell you anything that you don't already believe, because you've already embraced the gospel that's the true gospel. So it's not my innovation, John is saying. I'm not going to tell you anything innovative here. Is that clear? Okay. Now, taking off from the fact that this new teaching, the darkness is fading away and the true light is already shining. Now he takes off from that. The one who says he is in this light that is already shining, the one who says he is in this light, but who hates his brother, is still in the darkness even until now. The one who loves his brother, he continues in this light, and for him there is nothing to make him stumble. But the one who hates his brother, he is in the darkness, and he walks in the darkness, and he does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes. Okay, here now he makes a third statement that's going to be a criteria for judging these false teachers. If you claim to be in the light that Jesus' teaching brought into your life, you claim to be remaining in that light, but you hate your brother, then it ain't true. If he hates his brother, he's still in the darkness even until now. He's not in the light at all. It's the one who loves his brother. He's the one who continues in the light. And for the one who loves his brother, then there is nothing to make him stumble. And he's using a metaphor of, if we turned off the light and had to navigate this room, we'd trip over podiums and microphone stands and chairs, and we might hurt ourselves because we have no idea where we're going. We can't see reality in order to be able to navigate through reality. So we stumble and fall, and we do stupid, self-destructive things. We do really foolish things because we don't get it. We don't get why I'm here and who I am and what this reality is that I have to navigate. I just don't get it. So he's using the physical metaphor of a blind man or a person without light illuminating his path, being unable to walk at all, to navigate. And he says, that's what you're like. If you hate your brother, then you're somebody who doesn't have the light. And if you don't have the light, you stumble and fall. Now, what is he talking about? We need to understand what I think has to be in the background of this, and we have to understand what he means. Let's deal with what he means first. He doesn't mean the one who hates his brother is different than the one who hates his neighbor. He's not talking about the neighbor here. He's talking about the brother. The issue here is what is your perspective toward the other disciples of Jesus or other people who, well, what he means by brother is somebody who actually is a disciple of Jesus. You're claiming to be a disciple of Jesus. And then there are these people who actually are disciples of Jesus. What's your attitude toward them? Do you love them or do you hate them? And he's saying, if you hate them, then necessarily you hate the truth that they have embraced, the truth that they are, the light that they are living in the light of. You hate that light. So don't tell me you're abiding in the light when you hate the light. How do I know you hate the light? Because anyone who loves it, you hate them for loving it. He's going to revisit that in the first part of the body of his letter. He talks about Cain, who killed Abel, who hated Abel. And why did he hate his brother? Because his deeds were righteous and Cain's were evil. Because his deeds were evil and his brother's deeds were righteous. He hated his righteousness. Abel wanted to honor and respect God, and Cain hated him for wanting to honor and respect God. That's what he's getting at here. That if you don't have some kind of simpatico with people who love God and righteousness and truth, and therefore the teaching of Jesus and so on, if you don't have some kind of simpatico with them, then what does that say about you? Because you're claiming to love God and truth and light and the gospel. You're claiming all that, and yet you hate the very people who love it. That doesn't speak well for you, he's saying. You don't know the light. You don't have the light. You're not living in the light. And so you will stumble. Now, why is he bringing that up here? And why is that a criteria that he's using? I think to understand the background of that, that's why it's helpful to have 2 and 3 John to inform us about the circumstances behind this letter. Remember in 3 John, Diotrephes, who loved to be prominent among them or first among them, Diotrephes, who really liked the position of power and authority and glory and leadership and so on, and how he prevented those people sent from John from entering into their community and teaching. He prevented them from teaching, and if anyone opened up their home to show hospitality to the people sent from John, he kicked him out of the community. So the reason John is saying this is a criteria that I would use to recognize a false teacher when I see one is if the very people bringing the apostolic gospel are proactively resisted and rejected by somebody, then they don't love the truth. That somebody who's blocking them is not a lover of the truth and is not a follower of Jesus and does not love the light. They are blocking them precisely because they are proponents of the truth of Jesus. So notice how important it is that we understand that, because a passage like this, the one who says he is in the light but hates his brother is still in the darkness even until now, take that out of context. And just make this a claim that you begin to judge your life by. Forget that it's a brother. Think of it as a neighbor. Anyone here ever neglected to love their neighbor? I mean, even if you didn't proactively reject your neighbor, there are neighbors all over the place that I don't even know exist. And they have needs that I don't even know about. And, oh my goodness, I haven't met those needs that I don't know about. And there are people that pile a whole boatload of guilt on themselves because he says you're not in the light if you have failed to love your brother. I don't think that's what he's saying. He's not saying that if you have somehow not got around to doing the loving thing towards someone who has a need, you're not really a believer. He can't possibly be saying that. And it doesn't appreciate the context into which he's saying this. It's not failing to love, it's proactively hating that he has in mind. Proactively rejecting, proactively opposing, proactively holding in contempt someone. That's the problem. Not negligence or finiteness. You know, not being so finite that there are needs out there that I haven't actually met. That, of course. There's all kinds of needs that I can't meet. But it doesn't mean that I'm not a disciple of Jesus. So it's critical that we get the context and appreciate the context and get that right. Okay, any questions about 9? Yeah.
You might not need it. This might just mean it'd be me not having good Greek here, but on 2, on what's in the normal Bible, 2:8.
Okay.
Again, the new teaching. I am writing to you, and then there's a relative pronoun there.
Mm-hmm.
That you have what there. Is the truth. Can you just talk about what's the antecedent of that relative pronoun? Because it's not the teaching, because the teaching is in the teachings are feminine, and this seems to be a neuter relative pronoun.
Right, right.
So can you just fill that in? And it seems like you're acknowledging it's not teaching, but I'm just not sure what it is.
Notice the first word of the letter is the same thing. It's John seems to occasionally use the relative pronoun as an with an indefinite antecedent, that there's no actual grammatical antecedent in the text. It's just we would say the thing, so we'd start this, the thing which we have seen, da 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 da, and I think he's doing the same thing here. The thing is true for the thing that is true for him is also true for you, or the thing that is true of a follower of Jesus is also true for you. And what that thing is here comes in what follows, I think.
Can you unpack that?
Okay.
I guess the question now is, would you just unpack the following statement about the darkness passing away and the new light coming to be, or what?
I used to think he meant it on a broader scale, but I'm more inclined now to think that he means it on a more personal scale. And that is that when I have encountered the truth that Jesus came into the world to teach me, it informs me about my life such that it dispels the darkness, the ignorance, the lack of knowledge, the lack of wisdom, the folly that comes from that lack of knowledge, that it is dispelled. So with the coming of the teaching of Jesus, the instruction of Jesus, I become enlightened. But he seems to imply it's a process. It's the light is shining and the darkness is fading away. Now, I used to think he meant more in historical terms.
Yeah, but I think I've always kind of just assumed that, but I don't know where I got that.
Yeah, I think I'm more inclined because of it. Because of the way I retranslated it here, and now what I think he's seeing, it makes more sense in more individual, personal terms here. I mean, it'd be universal, and it would be true of anybody but I think he's speaking of. I think it's part of his reassurance. I see this happening in you. You know, you have embraced this, the word that you had from the beginning. You've embraced it, and the light is shining in you, and the darkness is passing away. And that's as it should be with those who are in him. Those who are disciples of Jesus, that's exactly what you would expect.
What do you think the meaning of loving your brother, what would be, I'm under the impression that it means on the basis of loving other believers, and how do you think that would, in today, look like?
You see it all over the place in our culture. The contempt that our culture has for good people. Let's see if I can think of a good example. Well, I mean, oftentimes good people are also corny people. So, you know, it is admittedly hard to separate that out sometimes. But when good people are hated in our culture, it's not simply because they're corny. It's because they're good. You know, they come. I mean, but in all seriousness, haven't you experienced that? There is a sentiment that runs deep within our culture that it holds in contempt people for the very good things that they endorse and embrace and are committed to. I mean, that in this the latest thing where the CEO of Chick-fil-A was just giving his political opinion about gay marriage, wasn't it? Or something like that. And the complete outrage of our culture toward him. How dare you? Casting their contempt in moral terms against this person who, in all honesty, I think, is committed to the concept of human sexuality and marriage that is true and is from God and is taught in the Bible. And the very fact that he actually believes that that's true is enough to get him crucified publicly by the elite, by the smart people, by the cool people, by the people who really know where it's at. You know, look at any late night comedy show and look at how much the butt of their jokes are people who have indicated some kind of commitment to actual integrity and goodness. They become a source of contempt and mockery. And our society just, yeah, right, kill them. You know, go get them, hold them in contempt, ridicule them to the end. That Jesus said, they did it to me. You can count on them doing it to you. If they hated the teacher, you know they're going to hate the students. So he just told people, I mean, John's going to call that in a few paragraphs the spirit of Antichrist. That there's the spirit of Antichrist that Jesus predicted would be in the world. And what he's getting at is Jesus told us that we're not going to get any kudos for being his disciples. We're going to get nothing but grief. And they're going to misunderstand you, and they're going to reject you. They're going to hold you in contempt. They're going to hate you for being my disciples. Well, that's just a reality. It's not something we should whine about. It just, what else are they supposed to do? They don't see the light. And so from their perspective, as sunk in darkness, we are obnoxious to them. Now, you know, all too often we're obnoxious because we're obnoxious. Also, I mean, that's also a reality. But that doesn't explain it all. Some of it is just, we are obnoxious because we are on the side of goodness and truth and righteousness, and we believe in it, and we embrace it, and we desire it, and we want it. And that's contemptible to the world.
Just to clarify, and in your paragraph 9, the first sentence there, the one who says he is in the light but who hates his brother, here you're talking, that's when you were referring to Diotrephes and those like him?
Right.
So in this paragraph, specifically, he is talking about those specific people.
Well, at least he has them in mind. Exactly.
Okay. And what they're doing by not letting the true teachers come and teach them.
Right. You know, some of you have been through exactly this kind of experience, where some of you in a particular institution were standing up for what you believed was what the Bible actually taught, and you got institutional opposition and contempt and hatred toward you, proactively, basically shoved aside, marginalized, because you believed in goodness and truth. That's what he's talking about. And so what he's saying is, if somebody proactively rejects their brother, someone who's trying to follow Jesus, and because you're trying to follow Jesus, you find that they hate you and marginalize you, that doesn't speak well for them. That they're, how can they be rightly related to truth when people who love the truth, they hate? That makes no sense, John says.
For John's audience, would they have understood the distinction that you presented to us between brother and neighbor? Would that have just been
automatic? I think so. John, in the body of the letter, is going to have two, he's going to divide the body of his letter into four parts. One is loving your brother, and number three is loving. And he's not being redundant. These are very, very different realities. There's loving your brother, and then there's just being loving because you should be loving. This goes to my enemy, my neighbor. Love knows no limits. Loving your brother is a very, very different phenomenon. In fact, it's really a different kind of love, right? Because to love my enemy doesn't mean I have simpatico with my enemy. You know, there's not something really cute about my enemy and I just find him adorable and I'm just attracted to him. That's not what we're talking about. Loving your enemy is a commitment to promote their well-being. That's love in that sense. And I can do that even to my enemy. Loving your brother is really all about liking them. I mean, what we would probably use the word like. If we don't like our brother, then there's something wrong with us. Well, in what sense? If I don't appreciate the commonality I have with them in that we have a mutual commitment to goodness and truth and righteousness and God and Jesus and so on, and I find that attractive because I like those kinds of commitments, that's the kind of love that you love your brother with. Anything else on that?
This is just a really general question, and I figure it might be a good thing just to tag on.
Okay.
Some of what you're talking about, the context of this, the older generation, the younger generation, made me think of something in Hebrews 13, I think, where he says, and I'm wondering if the other author is speaking into a similar situation. He says, "Remember your leaders who spoke the word of God to you. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever." And it sounds really similar. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. In just the couple minutes we have left, just so you know, I'm not totally making this up, this generation thing. Look at 10 and 11. Now, it's confusing when you read it in most of your English translations. It's kind of hard to get a fix on it. So let me just explain. We'll come back to this next week before we go on. But I write to you, precious offspring, because your sins have been forgiven you because of his name. I write to you, fathers, because you know that which has been from the beginning. I write to you, young men, because you have overcome the evil one. I write to you, dear children, because you know the Father. I write to you, fathers, because you know that which has been from the beginning. I write to you, young men, because you are strong, and the account from God persists among you, and you have overcome the evil one. Okay, the way to understand the structure of this is not that there are three groups, but there are two groups. Precious offspring is just his way of addressing them, and he does that throughout the letter. Beloved children, dear children, my children, that kind of stuff. So precious offspring in 10 and dear children in 11 are basically synonymous, and he's just saying, you guys, you wonderful, precious guys. I write to you, you wonderful, precious guys, because your sins have been forgiven you because of his name. Now he makes a distinction in them. There's two groups within you wonderful, precious guys. There's you wonderful, precious guys who are fathers. I write to you, fathers, because you know that which has been from the beginning. I write to you, young men, because you have overcome the evil one. So that's the generational distinction that I'm seeing in the letter. There are those of you that he classifies as fathers, and there are those of you who he classifies as young men. Then he repeats himself in the next one. I write to you, dear children. I write to you, you dear used guys, because you know the Father. Now he makes the same distinction. I write to you, fathers, because you know that which has been from the beginning. I write to you, young men, because you are strong and the account from God persists among you, and you have overcome the evil one. So there's this important distinction that he makes. And why does he go out of his way to make that distinction? There's got to be something in the background that makes that relevant. Otherwise, wow, what a bizarre thing to do. But what I'm proposing is what makes that relevant is, because he tells us here, I write to you fathers because you know that which has been from the beginning. And it's not him who is from the beginning. He's not talking about because you know God. He's saying, I write to you fathers because the gospel that first came to you, you were the ones that received it, and you have known it ever since then. He can't say that for the young men, and he doesn't say that for the young men. I write to you young men because you are strong and because the account from God persists among you. That is, you do believe it, but you haven't known it from the beginning, but you do believe it. You are strong and the account from God persists in you, and you have overcome the evil one. In spite of the obstacles to your coming to belief, you have overcome the evil one trying to prevent you from belief, and you have believed it. So since there's not only the asymmetry between fathers and young men, but there's an asymmetry of what he can claim for each group, that suggests to me that there's this generational difference that is somehow underlying the problems in the letter. And he's saying of both of them, to the extent that you believe the teaching of Jesus, you got it, both of you. You young men who are remaining faithful to that word, you got the truth. You fathers who have remained faithfully embraced that which from the beginning, you got the truth. You're on the right track. Well, we can talk more about that next week. Thank you.